A very good morning to you. It's Matt Shirley here on Times Radio. It's just gone 11 o'clock, so it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
The future king is in his counting house, counting all his money. But where does it come from? What do donors expect in return? And just how big a suitcase do you need to hold £1 million in cash? We take a look at Prince Charles's finances this morning. The oldest heir to the throne for almost 300 years and increasingly taking on some of the big duties from the Queen, including just recently in the state opening of Parliament.
My lords and members of the House of Commons, Her Majesty's government's priority is to grow and strengthen the economy and help ease the cost of living for families.
But with all this increased responsibility comes increased scrutiny of how he operates, including the way money passes through his office and charities. Well, Gabriel Pogrod is the Whitehall editor of the Sunday Times, who's been investigating all of this, and Prince Charles's finances keep ending up on the front page as a result. Morning, Gabriel. Thanks for joining us. What was the trigger of your particular interest in Prince Charles and his finances?
You know what? It all came about by accident, as many of the best stories do. Henry Zeffman and I were looking into the Tory party chairman, Ben Elliott. And readers may recall last year that we did a story revealing that a Tory donor had paid Ben Elliott's company, his concierge business, quintessentially, and off the back of that, booked to go on a private jet up to Charles's beloved estate in Scotland, Dumfries House, and have dinner with the future king. And off the back of this, we got a load of tips from people saying this sort of syndicate where the world's wealthy people can pay fixers or intermediaries and get in a room with HRH. I mean, you haven't even got a fraction of how big and institutionalised this all is. I ended up spending a lot of time poring over hundreds of documents that showed that Charles's closest confidant, the notorious Michael Fawcett, and a load of fixers had secured an honour for this Saudi billionaire. That's now under police investigation, but that was basically our way in. And since then, we've been marinating in the world of royal sleaze, and it makes politics look clean, to be frank.
And so let's work through some of them first of all. So the Saudi tycoon Khalid bin Mahfouz gave £1.5 million to a charity associated with Prince Charles, and then subsequently got CBE. That's now being investigated by the police. Then there was your revelation a week ago about this £1 million in a suitcase from Sheikh Hamad bin Jassim, former Prime Minister of Qatar. That's being in the charity that was a total of £3 million all between 2011 and 2015. They're now saying, oh, that was all in the past, a long time ago.
Half a decade ago, no less.
Yeah. And they definitely wouldn't take money in suitcases now.
If it was a year ago, they'd have said it was a tenth of a decade ago.
And now just yesterday, another revelation, this time involving Lord Brownlow, who listeners will remember was the guy who offered to pay for the gold wallpaper in Number 10. More recently, was being lined up to stump up £150,000 to build a treehouse for Boris Johnson at Chequers. Not for Boris Johnson, for his son. Although, you never know.
Key distinction,
can't rule it out. Explain what's going on with this story. How's Lord Brownlow now moved from politics into the Prince Charles story?
I mean, he's a fascinating man, Lord Brownlow, but he basically has this decade-long pattern of conduct of bailing out extremely powerful and influential but occasionally cash-strapped people. You mentioned the Boris, his relationship with Boris. He also was the white knight that rescued David Cameron's wife Samantha's fashion company when it was hemorrhaging £500,000 a year. He took a 10% stake in that. And then we revealed yesterday he'd also been bailing out Prince Charles. I mean, one of the sort of interesting structural factors over here that people probably wouldn't assume is Charles doesn't have that much money. It was actually in 2007 that he took out a £20 million loan in order to buy Dumfries House. It was going to be bought by an American buyer. Charles said to his friend, the Marquis of Bute, I'll put together some money, let me save it for the nation. Since then, it's been the sort of headquarters of his philanthropic empire and his weekend estate. But he'd basically struggled to pay the debt back ever since. He actually told an ITV documentary in 2012 that the debt kept him up at night. I don't think most people assume the future king spends his nights, in cold sweats thinking about the debt. But Brownlow is one of a number of people alongside the Saudi and HBJ, the former Qatari PM, who he's turned to in order to bail out his actually quite financially troubling situation.
Let's just focus on Dumfries House for a moment. I think we've got a clip. This is Prince Charles speaking to the BBC's Hidden Heritage in 2011 about why he wanted to take on that task of restoring Dumfries House.
When I'd heard about this house, you see, that there was difficulty with it and that they wanted to sell it and find a solution, but unfortunately it didn't happen. And I remember trying 4 years before it actually came up for sale as a problem. I tried to find a way of seeing if we could help sort it out or find somebody who might help, a sponsor, a donor, whatever, but it was just such an enormous task.
An enormous task, which has sort of got him into trouble. I suppose, is the starting point with this, is that Prince Charles wants to do good things. His heart's in the right place, maybe. You know, there's this house, it needed restoring. Or we'll come on in a minute and talk about the Knockroon development as well. But he starts off with, like, this is a good thing to do. But like you said, he doesn't have any of his own money, so he ends up getting into bed with people that probably, when it's on the front of a national newspaper, it looks like it would be better if he hadn't done that.
That's a great analysis. I think another thing as well is that it's not only that he wants to do good things and has good intentions when it comes to those good things. He doesn't respect the constitutional convention whereby even if he happens to have opinions, he doesn't act on them. I think this is probably the problem at the heart of it. For three decades, Charles has been lobbying and advocating for causes close to his heart. Some of them perfectly laudable, like restoring a dilapidated, beautiful 18th century Palladian manor. Others probably a little less laudable, like lobbying for homeopathic treatments to be made available on the NHS. But in a way, it kind of does a disservice to the debate to focus only on the weird and wacky things that he lobbies for. I mean, I do think his Foundation for Integrated Health is probably the most notorious, but he's also lobbied against modern architecture, which he happens to dislike. But even if it's great stuff, it's the fact that he feels this entitlement to lobby and advocate on behalf of his causes. That's why he set up all these charities. I mean, it's not a normal thing. The Queen doesn't have, charities through which tens of millions pass and go on to causes close to
her
heart.
What she does is she's the patron of existing charities, and which sort of bestows support upon them, but she's not involved in the fundraising and the day-to-day running of them.
Exactly. It's funny, like, in the newsroom, we often reflect on the word charity, but the moment that you introduce that word into a piece of journalism, people think, oh, well, it must be good then. I mean, the charity is just a legal structure that allows people to do things in the world, to pursue objectives that the charity deems to be charitable. But the question is it right for Charles to be intervening in the world in this way?
And I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? Is that by pursuing good things, he likes the environment, he likes, building houses for communities. Well, who could object to that? The point is that actually if you're observing the constitutional rule or the constitutional norm that you don't have an opinion on anything, then being for or against nice houses is not something that he should necessarily be sticking his oar into.
Yeah, I mean, during the we only know this because of the Guardian's years-long legal case, but, I mean, he lobbied new Labour ministers on everything from army helicopters to the Patagonian toothfish. I mean, he basically just has lots of big opinions,
yeah,
and he acts on them, and nowhere is his opinion about how the world ought to be more visible than in Dumfries. This is basically his Charles HQ. I mean, Clarence House is his London base, but in terms of where he goes to be at peace with the world, where he feels like his values are exhibited to visitors and to all those who pass through, I mean, Dumfries House is the place. So you're right to identify that this is kind of the blank canvas on which Charles has attempted to make an indelible impact.
And actually, the fact that it's in Scotland is a long way from Westminster, and the prying eyes of the media. I mean, a lot of this stuff probably goes a bit under the radar. So let's go back to the story that you had then yesterday, Gable. Lord Brownlow spent £1.7 million bailing out Prince Charles' failed eco village in Knockroon in Scotland. This is Professor Alan Dunlop. He's a leading Scottish architect who criticised the plan at the time. He spoke to Times Radio earlier about why he thought the scheme failed.
His heart was probably in the right place. I was first asked about Knockroon in 2010 and the creation of Scotland's Poundbury and whether I thought it would stack up. An analysis of Poundbury in Dorchester, which has a population of mostly professional classes, some 75,000 people, in comparison to Auchinleck and Cumnock, former mining villages whose industries, textile and engineering industries, have gone, has a population of 16,000. So from that point of view, I couldn't quite see how the thing could stack up right from the very start. I'm not necessarily talking about the architecture of it and the design and the overall look of it, but just from a purely development point of view, I couldn't understand how you could possibly make it work.
So that was Alan Dunlop speaking about Knockroom. We'll continue the conversation in a moment with Gabriel Pockham. We're also going to hear from Roy Anika, who's the Sunday Times' royal correspondent, as to how Prince Charles is trying to get his house in order as he prepares to become king, so that, there are fewer front-page stories about his finances. We'll continue that conversation in just a moment. It's Matt Chorley on Times Radio.
Times Radio with Matt Chorley.
Very good morning. It's Matt Chorley on Times Radio. We are taking a look at Prince Charles's finances and why they keep getting him on the front pages of the papers. Well, maybe one person who can try and stop that happening is Tobin Andre, is currently deputy editor of the Daily Mail. He's about to take over as the new communications secretary for the Prince of Wales and the Duchess of Cornwall, as revealed by Roy Anika, the royal editor of the Sunday Times, just yesterday. But I caught up with Roy a little bit earlier on to discuss Prince Charles and all of his problems and how focused he might be on taking on more responsibility from the Queen.
Well, I think we've been seeing that for the last few years. I mean, you know, the Prince of Wales and his household with the Duchess of Cornwall, you know, first and foremost, his main public role is to support the monarch. And given that what we've seen over the last few years, you know, the Queen no longer travels overseas, so he's stepped up his duties there for the very big sort of national moment sometimes now, things like at the cenotaph, the Queen no longer lays the national wreath, so Prince Charles is doing that. So yeah, the state opening of Parliament this year was opened by Charles and William. So we are seeing an ongoing trend in terms of the Prince of Wales stepping up more and more into that role of assuming a lot of her duties.
And with that increased responsibility and sort of public profile, is coming more scrutiny in terms of, you know, both what he does now, but also what's happened in the past. Do you think, I mean, nobody enjoys scrutiny particularly, but how does he feel about that, the sort of increased investigation, not least in the Sunday Times, about his finances, his foundations and charities and so on? How does he feel about that level of scrutiny?
I doubt he welcomes it, but at the same time, there's a big difference between the way the Prince of Wales and the Duchess of Cornwall look at media coverage. You know, his press secretaries have always said to me he is very much focused on his public work and not on whether he's in favour or out of favour in the headlines. But that said, you know, he won't be immune to knowing that big, these revelations that have come out, that some probes by the Charity Commission now into some of the revelations will, you know, make people question more and more about the future of how his charities are run, how much of an arm's length he has from them. So he's not blind. He understands that people will be asking some serious questions, and perhaps he needs to rethink his involvement with his charities.
And I suppose when you've had, you know, Prince Harry on one hand, Prince Andrew on another, making all the big headlines, it's not like this is the biggest thing which has threatened the royal family in recent times. But as we get closer to the point of him assuming the role of monarch, I suppose there's going to be more and more focus on the way that he operates. And so do you think he sort of needs to sort of get his house in order a bit more ahead of that?
I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, and I think he understands that. You know, when he turned 70 a few years ago, there was that documentary where he was asked, you know, very probing question, will you stop writing to ministers? Will you stop meddling? And he said, of course, I understand the difference between that role, my future role, and my role now. And as you say, the closer he gets to that role, you know, with an aging monarch who is now 96, the Prince of Wales really does need to, you know, when change of reign comes, he needs to be able to assume that role whiter than white, almost, with no, almost no sort of cause for criticism, because he's stepping into boots the Queen's one day, who really has, you know, conducted herself in an almost sort of, I don't know, she's never been through any scandals like this. Yes, there have been scandals in her reign, of course, tons of controversy, but we've never seen anything like, you know, question marks raised over her involvement with some of the charities or question marks over money. So I think he really does, yeah, you're right, he needs to try and sort out that side of his role and his life, so that when he does take the top job, things are much more straightforward and there'll be less scrutiny on that front.
And how much of this, if being fair to Prince Charles, you know, a lot of this is to do with charitable works, you know, trying to do good, you know, not all of it successful, but, you know, starting out on the basic premise of, well, you know, building some houses here or helping out good causes there. And actually, in order to do that, you know, and politicians find the same thing, you end up sort of swimming with people who have got lots of money and maybe do or don't want something in return. And it's this sort of murky world of, you know, we want the royal, supporters of the royal family, want the royal family. With that, you expect sort of bells and whistles and pomp and circumstance and all of that. But that requires being paid for. And so, you know, and it's where, I suppose it's where you draw the line is to, you know, how close you get to those people who've got big checkbooks.
I think I would say two things on that. First of all, I would say absolutely the Prince of Wales's heart is in the right place when it comes to, you know, charitable works. Look at what he's done with the Prince's Trust and dozens of his charities, which do amazing things. I think the other thing I would say is perhaps he needs to keep a closer eye on who is managing those charities for him and maybe reassess, does he really need to be raising all that much money? You know, Dumfries House, for example, his Palladian mansion up in Scotland, which he saved for the nation, it has, you know, the foundation has done a lot of good work around that. But did he really need to be raising millions and millions of pounds for the restoration of, you know, some bridges? Or, I think he just needs to rethink about that because, you know, you're right. He does need to be very careful about who he's associated with. He is the future king after all. And perhaps the role of his charitable work and the way in which he goes about fundraising perhaps could be slightly reassessed.
And just sort of looking forwards then, do you think that there are active moves to sort of tidy things up a bit, or has he not yet sort of got to that mental position of, you know, moving from the, you know, long, you know, he's waited for a long time heir to the throne, that actually maybe, you know, he always talks about slimming down the monarchy, actually slimming down his operations would be quite a smart thing.
Well, I think we've already seen that, you know, his one of the closest people to him who was so deeply involved in the Prince's Foundation charity, Michael Fawcett, no longer works for the Prince of Wales. You know, that's a big move towards tidying things up. He's currently subject to, you know, involved in matters that the police are investigating. We saw it the weekend. There was a story saying that one of the Prince's charities is advertising for a compliance officer, which I think tells you that much more focus is now being looked at compliance of these organisations than perhaps had been before.
That was Roy Nika, the Sunday Times' royal correspondent, giving us her assessment of that. Gabriel Pogman's still here, Whitehead of the Sunday Times, who's been doing a lot of the stories on this. I suppose I should ask you, Gabriel, what does Clarence House say about all this? Apart from, I imagine, being annoyed that you keep phoning them on a Friday afternoon and saying, oh, I've got another donor that I've got some questions about. Do they feel like they have questions to answer, that this is an issue? Are they trying to sort of clean things up a bit?
Great question. They're certainly annoyed. You mentioned, Roy mentioned a few moments ago, Michael Fawcett's resignation. I mean, there are five investigations.
We should explain, Michael Fawcett was like the closest aide to Prince Charles.
Yeah, he'd been forced to resign twice from Clarence House. He came back again and again. I mean, he was the man that could make things happen for HRH. He was the person who gave effect to Charles's will in the world. And off the back of our story last year, he quit, most presume for the last time. One royal insider said to me he was extremely conspicuous by his absence at the Queen's recent Jubilee. People would usually go to him to get seats. He wasn't even at the event. What did Clarence House say? Their steadfast position, in particular on the honours question, and which is obviously so toxic for him because it's the literal police involved, is that he had no idea about any of it. And often the Clarence House position is, these are questions for Charles's charities, which are independent organisations run by their trustees. So their basic position is that Charles knew nothing about the honours deal. He has, and all sort of legal and fiduciary responsibility falls on the trustees. So basically, ask somebody else, but not us.
Well, let's focus on that then. And there is now a police investigation into the suggestion of an honour being given as a result of donations. Norman Baker's a former Liberal Democrat MP and former minister. He's author of What the Royal Family Don't Want You to Know. And Norman joins me now. Norman, you wrote to the police calling them to look into exactly this.
Yes, indeed, Matt, because it seemed clear to me from the letter that was published in the Sunday Times and the Mail on Sunday, there was a prima facie evidence that an offence had been committed under the 1925 Honours Act, in that an honour and indeed help with citizenship application had been offered explicitly, it seemed to me, in return for money for Prince Charles's good causes. And the Metropolitan Police then subsequently wrote back to me and said, we are now beginning a criminal investigation, and that, as far as I'm aware, is continuing. And it's relevant that you bring that up, because as has just been said by Gabriel, the response from Clarence Household, which is not me, Gov, I don't deal with these matters, Prince Charles says, it's done by some flunky somewhere, I sail above it all. Well, of course, that defence, to my mind, has been shot through by the fact that Prince Charles was caught, to use a vernacular, red-handed, receiving bags of money in form of mace and carriers from the former Qatari Prime Minister. And now we know that he's been engaged in the same direct way with Lord Brownlow, according to Sunday Times front page, in terms of money for Dumfries House. So it seems very clear that Prince Charles is intimately involved with these matters.
I'm interested, Norman, in the fact that when Lord Brownlow was involved in paying or not paying for Boris Johnson's wallpaper, Westminster was alive with calls for investigations and resignations and, you know, the Labour Party all over it and Conservative critics of Boris Johnson were all over it. And it, you know, the story was given endless legs by interventions by politicians. This time round, Gabriel does extraordinary work week after week in the Sunday Times, and he's met by total silence from the Westminster establishment. And I know you're not an MP anymore, but did you feel when you were an MP under pressure not to speak out about what the royal family were up to?
Well, I mean, there should be voices in Parliament, not least of all, because the donations in question, Lord Brownlow and the Qatari Prime Minister, were not included in the court circular, and therefore a distinct attempt was made to hush them up very clearly. But look, I mean, in 18 years I was in Parliament, I think I was the only member of Parliament to initiate a debate on anything to do with the royal family, which was I had to link it. So they make it very difficult for you. I had to link it back to an obscure Treasury paper in 1993 in order to get it past the House of Commons clerks. But the wider point is this. MPs, many of whom are Republican in nature, I might tell you, particularly in the Labour and Lib Dem groups, don't think it's a matter to be raised because they think it's either a vote loser or as a distraction, or be painted as some sort of extremist, and therefore they keep their head down. They say it's more important to deal with A, B, and C. That's where they are. Actually, this is very important because this is about our constitution. This is about the future monarch in terms of Prince Charles. It's about how public money is spent. And my view has always been that those who are receiving public money, whether it's MPs, councillors, people in the health service, or anybody else, Network Rail, they should be held publicly accountable. And the public accountability for Prince Charles and the royal family is woefully inadequate, not least of all because Prince Charles lobbied the government to exclude the royal family as far as possible from the Freedom of Information Act.
You talk about how difficult it is even to mention the royal family. This was the other day, Keir Starmer mentioned the Queen during PMQs, and Common Speaker Lindsay Hoyle intervened.
Yes.
We normally would not. Sorry, Premier. We normally would not, and quite rightly, mention the royal family.
Even the very mention of the royal family is found on. Never mind, you know, saying, well, I'm not sure if the heir to the throne should be receiving money in carrier bags.
Well, look, I mean, at any one time, the minimum percentage of the population that's Republican is 20%. It goes up to about 45%. It ebbs and flows between those two figures. But if you take 20% of the House of Commons, that's about 120, 130 MPs. How many actually say anything at all about the royal family? Well, Chris Bryant does occasionally, and that's it, I'm afraid. And, you know, we're not representing, the MPs are not representing the public properly by failing to address these issues. There are huge sums of money involved, as well as propriety issues, and the MPs ought to be really far more involved. I'll be writing shortly to Meg Hillier, the chair of the Public Accounts Committee, because there are so many issues about royal finance to be looked at. But where's the Public Accounts Committee on this? Nowhere.
Yeah. Norman Baker, it's really good to speak to you. Final word to Gabriel Pogrand. Where does the story go next? Do you have more of these cases to wade through, these hundreds of documents you're looking at?
We do. I don't know that you'll see anything imminent, but there is more. And I think we just need to see where this Met investigation goes. I mean, there are investigations by the Met, the charity regulator, the Scottish charity regulator. I think there are about six of them right now. So we'll have to see if they are actually going to, if these investigations will have bite or whether they'll sort of defer to the establishment, as these things often turn out to be. But we'll see.
Gabriel Pockett, the Whitehall editor of the Sunday Times, thanks so much for joining us. Also, thank you to Norman Baker, a former Lib Dem MP and author of The Royal Family Don't... What the Royal Family Don't Want You to Know. And we also heard from Roy Anika, the Sunday Times Royal Correspondent, as well. And that brings us to the end of The Big Thing today. Don't forget, you can always, if you've only just tuned in, you can always listen back to The Big Thing. It's available on the Red Box podcast, wherever you get your podcasts from. You get The Columnist as well.